The 1994 Salt Lake Sunstone Symposium presents session number 355, Contemporary Mormon Poetry, featuring M. Shane Bell, Donna Cheney, Wade Bentley, Virginia Ellen Baker, and Kara O'Sullivan.
I'd like to welcome everyone to this panel. This is, actually I don't remember the title of it. What did we give it? Contemporary Mormon Poets, okay. And actually what this is, of course, is an annual panel that we do in which I invite people who have published poetry in Sunstone to come and read some of their poems and talk about their work. I'm Shane Bell. I'm the poetry editor at Sunstone. And I'll just ask my guests to introduce themselves and say something about their work and where they've published and what they're currently working on and doing. And then we'll take some time and read some of our poems and go from there. Jenny.
My name is Virginia Baker. Shane has been a wonderful help to my career. He's published a lot of my poetry in Sunstone, and I've had a few other things done. I've had mostly short stories. I'm a science fiction writer, and I've been published in Tomorrow Magazine and Writers of the Future, Volume 5, and I will be published in Isaac Asimov's Magazine this fall, and that's kind of fun. I'm currently under contract for my first novel, which is very nerve-wracking. So I haven't been concentrating as much on my poetry as I should have, but I have had time to write a few new poems, and it's just been a lot of fun.
That's great. Donna.
I'm Donna Cheney. Besides being published in Sunstone, I'm in Computers and Composition, Computer User, Computer News. I've gone computer freezing. I have no idea why. They recommend me to each other, I guess, and Exponent 2 and some other minor publications. I'm a faculty member at Weber, and I teach Shakespeare, Milton, and science fiction. So.
Great. I guess I should mention some of the places I've been published. I've also been published in Asimov's and Fantasy and Science Fiction and Tomorrow and Amazing Stories and Poems and Dialogue and various places like that. I had a poem nominated for the Risling Award back in 91. A poem about a country that no longer exists, the Soviet Union. So it was an interesting thing. Let's just go ahead and read our poems then. Who would like to? Jenny? We'll ask you to start.
Okay. I may have to stand at some point. I'm recovering from pneumonia, so I have a hard time sitting down. In death, I loved you more. Ekaterina, did the grave give you freedom? Do you sway the graces with your dance, like you did mine? Did you like this dance? Eyes wet and round, the green of water lilies, each step a cringe against imagined wrath, against all that is unfair and held in the world. How you loved to dance. I held you before your mouth heated horror and grew it there in your heart. It was not enough. What you needed could fill the skies, the unfairness of it. I watched as you went down. You hated me for seeing, but held on to me still. Who else would know your song, the beauty of it, gone but still remembered? I would. I do. If death is ever kind, it will be kind for you. The stillness of your limbs came before, you knew, and the quiet around me still dances with you. I am left behind in the procession, knowing that duty is heavy, but hard to put down.
We talked before we started about reading maybe five poems and then to kind of give everyone an idea of each of our voices.
Okay. Ophelia passes. Her humble feet bared to dirt and grass, bled roses everywhere she went. At a shallow pool past Elsinore, the maid sang while the sun planted fullness on the vines in her hair and begged to remember its fire on the fine russet threads of the millinery where she had woven her afternoons, or the color of his eyes watching her, pale beneath a darker blue, a burnished ore, and the indigo of his smile. This light in spring eclipsed her name, its shadows dappled on her eyes, clouds scudding over a plain choked with poppies. At the water's edge she held buttercups beneath her chin. In the low croak of lilies she saw her own ghost, her death in the vision of a godhead composed of the father, his son, and her lover, laughing the tang of bitter ale, warmed by a fire spiced with clover and winter wheat. A tear may have rippled it, or the splash she made as she reached, say, to catch them in her hands, and found none. She searched the pool all that day, talking to that woman, that other, in the water with the twigs in her hair. Each step cast her image further out. The sun descended, flared across the surface of the water, and made a crown of small dying suns, glinting motes in its halo like flies. Her eyes caught new visions in that light, and the honeysuckle bloomed to pull her down, heavy in her leaves. She sank slow enough to watch the path of her falling cleave the world and swirl it clean above her. The hovering images mulched a balm on her open eyes. The clouds on them beat a moment's pulse while the swaying roots of willows held her head. A swan curved its crowned neck above her shadow. Its wings were bright with the sun's going down, impossibly white. The copper of its feet churned the water, and this hushed wake alone marked her passing. This one's called Discord in Sibling Minor. We fight without saying a word, our weapons, smiles, and the silent, transgressing ghosts that hum between us, small hatreds and a narrow window on the past that shines up brittle mirrors and heliographs our aspects in small lighthouse bursts. Each word as we meet is weighted, each gesture mined with analysis. What we are is nothing to what we remember, and what we remember stings and brings up fantasies as irrefutable as glass. Strangeness grows so lush between the times we come together. In our silent spaces, we birth hydras and hundred-headed similes for the lives we never knew and call it good. We are strangers, you and I, refugees of blood sharing only the smallest circumstance of bone and indigent marrows, interlopers of a native soil that stirred only to pass along its seed and die, each digging still to find what piece of ourselves we might have left behind. There is no common country between us, only that map of seeming sequence that our parents drew us off long years before. I see myself reflected 1,000 times in your eyes, and in each soul-like prism I am covered in amber, forever at odds with each aspect of the moon and the elliptical path it takes around your sage and maddening smile. Your faith is unshakable, untainted, and still you haunt me. Sister, brother, sibling personae, dragging your baggage of unaltered past continued into the present, and your children, beautiful, sweet, and poisoned, they have your eyes. Tell me, when you send your children off to our secret silent war, do you tell them that we have grown apart as independent countries, secessionists to our union and our parents' blood, blindfolded and apart? The only war in which we so consummately love our enemies is in this tug of umbilicus we can never let go. Only here do we kill what we love with our memories, and oh, God, how I cover my eyes at the likenesses I see, soulless and thriving in the soil of our seeming differences. We have all been bruised, smiling so much. This one's called Don Quixote in the Modern World, and it reflects a lot of my early problems adjusting to reality after getting out of school and having to go to work writing documentation. Lynn will probably get some out of this. Bah, Pancho. Hold no mirrors here. The purest nights are too damn bright, and science is never truth without some source of tempering beauty. The words are succulent, Pancho, but if pi r squared has an area, still it has no soul. Its speaking leaves me weak, and with every dawning day another piece of that damned pie upon my face. I live by such a feeble grace. If I could, I'd rest above the roots of Spain and sleep away a century, until at last my idle thoughts decayed to rich, momentous histories. I read a book a year ago. Some pages and I beneath a tree, a fellow in Maine once slept like this, walked into the woods and was not missed until his time clocks rusted with the rain that did not touch him once upon any time. I joust machines. Even in a dreaming day when the skies are filled with an indigo wind and the windmill's blades clatter uttermost sighs, I must produce. They do not pay for languid thought from minds at play. By need of food I am reduced to work, to live, to breathe upon deductions and reductions, while the best of bread is found in waking dreams. The circuitory mistress babes a wan synthetic muse. She stands and waits. Every silent move portrays the arms propelled, the click, click, click of her metal tongue, the basic flesh of a man compelled to crawl inside her. While she suckles me, I sharpen my teeth against her fetal pose and taste of milk, wrung from air and dreams as it dries to chaff against my lips. It hurts. Dulcinea, can stars be written into memories that are not made, any more than horse touch love on the face of money? In dreams they love. Dance with me. You see, even a harlot may find in her step one graceful final arabesque. Lift your skirts, then. Dance. The frenzy of the fatal tarantella will lash our flesh and blood to peruse the serpent's hooded head and raise the dead, and raise the dead. This last one's set in Utah. Driving down to Moab, the Book Cliffs. Stopping at Green River, we pass through a place called Book Cliff Lodge, where a woman turns to another and says, "This place ain't got the sense to die." My eyes raise to the copper-red cliffs. The sun fires the stone into a low-banked furnace. This adobe is the color of my soul when it is warm. Each year is woven like a ribbon through the stone, the cliffs, a north star of long, unending wall that draws the skyline down. "Walk my length," the ribbons say, and the wind laughing through the brush, sweeping over my feet, and suddenly I want to dance. Signs and symbols flash by at 60, the birds fly backwards. The cliffs, they follow as we move, and move stone temple tigers, slow as earth, but stealthy, each stone an eye, a listening ear. We turn toward Moab, and they stop, falling away. Standing still, so mute and brilliant now against the rivaling blue overhead, they show a pyramid on a penny's head. A crop of thigh where the two walls meet is undone by shadows, struck by the heat. The stone puts forth a plume of smoke, and the book cliffs breathe.
So wonderful, Jenny. Yeah. I've loved her work for as long as I've known her, I think, as a poet. And it's interesting, for years I've been mining her poems for titles. And I just have to say that I did have a title for this panel that I turned in, and it was taken from her poem Discord and Sibling Minor. I was going to have this panel titled That Map of Seeming Sequence, which I thought was a wonderful title. I'm doing a book for Signature Books, a book of poetry of contemporary Mormon poets, and I'm also using a title. The title of that book is another line from Jenny's work, But Dawn and a New Horizon. And I guess I might as well mention Washed by a Wave of Wind, which was also taken from her work. So there's been quite a bit.
He's a very discerning reader.
I'll read five of mine now. This one is titled, If the Din of Cities Makes the Moon, which is the first line also. If the din of cities makes the moon shine dimly in the night, if the touch of concrete and tin drowns the sound of water, if the sight of cheap billboards masks the fragrance of all daisies or the taste of choke cherries picked on hot fall days, put down the basket and walk away. Stand silent through the blush of dusk, and later, in the cold of night, kneel on desert rock to touch it. Hear your fingers move across its ancient surface. Put your ears to the rock and smell again the bright, sharp taste of life. I also wrote a poem about the book cliffs, and I should say how Jenny and I came to these poems. We were on a book signing tour that Signature Books sent us on for Washed by a Wave of Wind. And we were riding in a van together down to a book signing in Moab in St. George. And on the way, Jenny and I challenged each other to write poems about various topics. So we both looked at the book cliffs and said, write a poem. And so Jenny's read hers. This was the one that came to me. The snow has melted from these cliffs, and the soft December light that still at midday blush the rock with warmth brush the page I write on with the certainty of flowers blooming fragrant in the south. The next two poems are going to be published in Dialogue. This one is called In a Far Land. So many women on their knees that if I knew how to tell them they could find hope here, or that there the men would be kind, and when the sun rose their hopes could rise with it, but especially if they would resolve to walk away from all who once hurt them to some far land where they could day by day remake their lives in the image of their hearts, I would tell them, no, I would walk there with them, so that in the stillness of that hot noon and later in the blush of dusk, I could take their hands and never need to whisper peace. This one is called Listening to Mozart's Requiem While Crossing the San Rafael, which was another assignment from Jenny. We were listening to the Requiem as we crossed the San Rafael, and Jenny said, write a poem about this, and it took quite a while to actually come up with something that could bring the two together. The requiem matched the smell of death on the leather of my coat, and the fear in the music lingered in the sudden stillness after canyon echoes above the overlook. Mozart is dead. Mozart is dead. The fear in his music could still grip my heart if I would let it, if I could stop looking at that eagle on the rock waiting to eat carrion and watching us drive past, watching us as we listen to the music of Mozart, who is dead. Mozart is dead. He is long dead, and his fear could not stop death. His music might stop the fear if it were not for the stillness after echoes, if it were not for the finality of carrion, if it were not that Mozart is dead after all. Mozart is dead. I wonder this, how did it go for him? How did he feel his death, and did his music echo in his head then and match the fear in his heart, and did the fear linger with any part of him, waiting to hear the others say, Mozart is dead, Mozart is dead. And this one is titled Lights in Ed's House, and this was published in The Pillar. The lights in Ed's house are not his, and I cannot look at them. He is gone with all the others. Where will I find new friends? Whose house with lights will I pass and think he is home? I would be welcomed there. I'm left to hear the wind and not their words. I'm left to hear the bare branches of fall tap windows. I am left to make others remember them. The dances, the hiking, the drinks on desert nights, and how stars shined on him and him, the moonlight in his hair, the moonlight on the water in his cup, the moonlight of those nights.
There's one. Well, let's give Shane.
Thank you.
They're so serious. Let me give you a different kind. This is called the Senior Prom from Hell. The popular boys had all asked girls, but still, I wanted to go. So I asked George if he, perhaps, would for the night be my beau. He would be safe, and he could dance, for he was enrolled in a class. So I took a chance and offered Dad's car, which really took some brass. He looked at me long, mumbled a yeah, but he grinned with a hint of cheer. The pimple on his nose turned red, and so did my face, I fear. Though I towered over him by an inch at least, and in heels by 3 or 4, I decided that a flat-foot dance would for me be a bore. He brought a corsage of 3 blue flags, not the roses of my dreams. I sneezed through the night and wiped my nose as it ran in a steady stream. I discovered early that he could dance, but certainly not with me. The ballroom class had really helped, but he was getting a D. He stepped 12 times on my open-toed pumps till I could stand no more. So I ate cake till I was green. He spilled punch on my dress and the floor. We early escaped in my dad's new Ford. I drove while he leaned back and sighed. I skidded on ice in front of his house and peeled up the whole left side. I ran up the stairs to my room at home and flopped down on the bed. Never again would I ask a guy out. I've learned. Through tears, I said. Next Monday in school, I scarce looked at George, but he met me at the door. School ring in his hand and a song in his heart, he vowed true love evermore. Shane said he wanted to hear my voice. I have lots of different voices. I'm trying to decide which voice. This poem was published in one of the computer books you might be interested in. It's entitled, Even Picard Reads Books. In the 24th century, as the vehicle we are in streaks through between the stars, easy voice commands change computer orders, and people still curl up on their couches with leather-backed books. New worlds have been discovered, strange sentient species disseminated, and imaginations still work between red vellum covers. Hands hold a stylus to sign names on report boards, interactive with a mainframe powered beyond hertz, and fingers still love the feel of fine ivory papers. Computer-dependent to the core, we turn for comfort, not to our mainframe ship, but to those simple square blocks of printed matter which carry us outward and inward, fast as thought. This one is called Women Quilting, and it's been published in a quilting magazine. First, there were four quilters, two on each long side, rolling toward the center. My grandmother's, my mother, and my young self stitched tiny stitches round a coming round the mountain, pieced in brown and two greens and a clear bright yellow. And my grandmother's told me of when their own mothers literally came round the mountain to settle in the wild back country. Then there were two quilters, my mother and I, on two short sides, rolling toward each other. We stitched a double wedding ring, pale pink and blue pieces of my childhood dresses set in unending rings on a white background. And my mother told me of her courtship and marriage to my father, of the early times when they were close and loving. Then there was one quilter, working on a long side in solitude. I stitched the fine stitches they had taught me around the edges of a lone star pattern, bits of their best silky dresses in deepest red and dusky gold and pearl white bursting on a background of night sky blue. And I remembered time spent with the women I have loved, their care as my earliest stitches were big and awkward, but the work kept in because I was their little quilter. Now there are two quilters. My daughter and I work on a side together, rolling toward the far distant end, stitching around the intricate leafy pattern of an early in the autumn. Dark red and faded green, tans and russets and spots of bright orange interlock on a rich earth brown. And I tell her of our mothers, of stories behind our quilts, and lives that we have shared. Then I have, because this is Sunstone, a couple of LDS poems that I have not read elsewhere and wanted to bring here. This first poem is in two parts, and it's part of a book kind of like Spoon River Anthology that I'm working on about a little cemetery in Idaho. These are real people. The first part is called Jed Dunn, and they speak for themselves. The sharp black eyes of Jed Dunn looked out from under white, craggy brows. He was the meanest man in the valley, and he was the bishop. "No," he said, "it's not his fault, it's yours. No woman is justified in leaving her husband. Not a good woman, not one sealed in the temple, anyhow. You got to go home. What's a man going to do, kill you? Don't be selfish, you got to think of your kids." Getting up, he ended the interview, showed her out of the office, put a reluctant hand into her husband's waiting paw, then stretched, a contented man with a good night's work. Well done. And this is called Ruth Madison. Ruth went home, chastened by the bishop's sting. She fed her kids and went to bed with Carl. "So," she said, "I guess that's right. You never did hurt me. Very much. Sorry, I thought he'd get in the middle. I'll be all right now." For 2 years, nothing happened. They went along just fine. She cooked and cleaned, with only an occasional black eye. Then at the funeral he cried, and everyone comforted him. "Poor man," they said, "losing his wife like that." And this one is called DNC 114 and After. DNC 114 is about David Patton, and it's a blessing on David Patton and his service. David Patton, of course, who is one of the main heroes of the church, really, was wounded fatally at the Battle of Crooked River near Far West. And I think the rest of it will speak for itself. David Patton, man of faith, prayed to be a martyr. He led a Mormon charge up a hill and was killed. "Keep the faith," he said to his wife and children, and died, a fulfilled, happy man, having given his death freely, assured exaltation and eternal life. Left behind, his wife, unnamed in sacred writ, dried her tears and led his children across the plains, nourished them, reared them, toiled and knew anguish. All her life she struggled against poverty and pain. A very old woman at 40, she died unblessed, knowing herself unworthy of joining her husband's bliss.
Okay. Wonderful.
Started funny.
Yes. Well, let's take a stab at the question they posed for us in the brochure here. Maybe I should just find that and read it, if I can. Where are we here? Right here. They wanted us to say, to take a stab at the perennial enigmatic question, what is it that makes a Mormon poem Mormon? Or a Mormon poet Mormon? I guess we could go either way on that. Shall I start with that, since I'm the poetry editor here? I've been thinking about this, and frankly, I don't think there's a lot that sets us apart. I get poems from all over the country, from people of all religious backgrounds, or non-religious backgrounds, as the case may be, and they send me absolutely, in the cases of the poems that I take, gorgeous poems in which people have led and talk about high ethical ideals. Certainly nothing that's unique to us in that way. And I think high ethics, you know, and the desire to live a good and decent life is out there amongst people generally. And so, I've taken poems from all kinds of people, from all kinds of backgrounds. It's interesting to me to get the poems from the RLDS people and see some of the things they write about. Very few dealing with their church, at least that they've chosen to send me. Nature poems and poems about the West and the Midwest, of course, Missouri, and places where they've lived, and not much dealing with the church or its history, really. So as far as the publishable poems go, I'm not sure that there's a lot that has set us apart. I think we are Mormons, but we're also part of a larger society that's striving to do the right thing in many ways, and we're just part of that. So there's an attempt at an answer. Any other ideas?
Well, I wouldn't call my poems Mormon. I don't think I'd do that to them. I don't like doing that to myself half the time, so I have a hard time. No, I definitely would never assign such a specification. I do know that I'm a poet. I do know that I'm mostly Mormon. But I don't even think I'd call myself a Mormon poet. It's too restrictive. And usually, you know, it's funny, people try to classify things like this, and they don't realize that classifications usually and probably should come after the fact, 50 years after, 100 years after, where the scholars come in and they quantify and classify a work. To do anything else is to force somebody to live in a very narrow margin and treat very narrow subjects. And I do look through my thesis, and I've got a lot of stuff in here that deals with religion and mostly coming to terms with religion in the real world, if you can call BYU the real world. I don't know if you can or not, but that kind of, I'd say, obsession with the topic matter has eased quite a bit in my subjects, so...
I think there's a degree of spirituality in all of our work, and certainly in most of the poems that I've taken. You certainly see that, I think. And that probably comes a lot from our background. Again, that's not unique to us. You know, you see that in people, in the Jewish poets who send me poems, and, you know, any other background that you want to name. And you see it in the people who claim to have no religion at all. Spirituality, I think, transcends organizations, if we want to say that. I think, though, that we have, all of us, written poems that touch on topics that would be unique to this area, poems of the West, and certainly poems of our heritage and culture. So that might classify us, I guess, a little bit that way. And I was going to say something else, and I can't think about it. If that comes to me, I'll come back.
I don't mind being called a Mormon poet, and I am sometimes. And the thing that makes me a Mormon poet is the way I approach certain topics. David Patton is a Mormon poem. Who's going to understand that otherwise? I have a wedding poem that's a Mormon poem, and I have some other unique topics. I don't write about green jello or wheat grinders, you know. But I think as Mormons, we approach spirituality from a slightly different angle, and that because we are poets and by nature are philosophic, we approach them with the spirituality side of us with a quest. And I think that's probably one of the things that I look for in a Sunstone poem or a dialogue poem or an exponent 2 poem is one that we share that quest for spirituality, that evaluation in a unique way. Like, as you say, the writers, the Russian writers, write about Russia from a particular viewpoint, and the Jewish writers write about that. But to be called only a Mormon poet, I've also been called a computer poet. And I think, what is a computer poet? just because I publish in computer books or talk about computers, that's different. But that's a different side of me. And I think most of us as poets have different voices and different sides. Most of all, I'm a poet, above all else, whatever I write about. I think that's how I would identify myself.
That's good. Go ahead. I was just going to say, and I think it's, like Jenny was saying, this definitely the scholar's point. Maybe we're too close to it to really see it. In 100 years from now, people come back and say, well, clearly, you know, this whole group of people were dealing with these things, and here you see it. Go ahead. What was your question?
No, we become more aware of it, I think. We're sensitive to it because of the kind of culture we live in, but it's everywhere.
That's true. Go ahead.
Do you receive poems from, say, RDLR, LSD people?
I do.
The bishop is Venus Downtown. See, she has...
Yes.
Because I thought maybe Marvin's here would take that liberty to say it. And they should be Venus men, and how many people would do it?
Shocking, isn't it?
Love it.
You often find, if you look at most of the poetry, like English poetry and American poetry, for people who are deeply religious, usually the themes have to do with struggling to find some kind of groove in which they can live, to live with the truth that their soul tells them and live with a lot of the catechisms that they grew up with. And, you know, especially Eliot and Yeats and people like that who are now known for a lot of their religious work and how the religions that they belong to influence their work. But a lot of it is, you know, very rarely, even when they're conservative, do you find them saying, you know, all is well in Zion. It's usually something that bothers them, that makes them passionate enough to bother to write a poem about.
That's a good point. Maybe that's one of the poet's jobs, is to point out things that need to be improved and worked on and areas we can concentrate on in that way.
I used to get terribly jealous of people that I knew who had beautiful voices or something like that, and they could just sing beautiful songs, because whenever I write a poem, I get in trouble. It makes somebody mad.
You're probably doing the right thing then. Yeah. Any other questions? Why don't we read some more poems then? Let's go.
This way.
Okay, Donna, if you want to read one. Let's do them just one at a time, and we'll just go down the row.
You might enjoy. This is another poem from the graveyard in Idaho. It's called Tombstone Competition. In a southeast corner of Idaho sits a well-tended graveyard. Tombstones sit in neat lines, straight and gray and proud. Just a small, friendly, comfortable place to sleep. Some stones were carved 50 years ago, but the fashion has become to choose one's epitaph, leaving only the death date to be filled in when convenient. The Hazlitt's, filled in 30 years ago, has a single rose above the family name. Next to them lie the Jensen's, dead only 25 years, with a rose for her and a sheaf of wheat for him, both roses and wheat take extra care in southeast Idaho. The stone for Mabel and Arthur Simpton, dead 15 years, features two roses and three wheat sheaves, plus an engraved Salt Lake temple and their wedding date on a scroll beneath. But the largest stone belongs to the Whittons, not dead yet. Their gravestone has a piano for her with a rose on top, a set of carpenter tools for him encircled by wheat, a very large temple cut in deep relief with clouds, seagulls, trees, and a smiling sun over a convoluted scroll with both wedding date and sealing date. In the newest part of the cemetery is a single narrow stone with just a name carved in, the date last month. A real rose lies drying in front, and a brave red, yellow, and blue windsock flies in the harsh southeast Idaho wind.
That's great. And that's a Mormon poem. But I think that would certainly transcend. Audiences outside would enjoy reading that, I think, and get a lot out of it. So that's good. This is one called Anticipating Snow. Snow has fallen twice on the valley, but it did not stay. You watched it settle on concrete and fallen leaves to block all color for an instant before melting. You know snow will fall again and not melt. The mountains are white with snow. You look up to see it, but after a time, like an old man, you let your eyes squint at the absence of snow. You look at cliffs where black, wet rock shows through. You cross streets but watch the snow. You do not watch your feet splash into puddles of melted snow. The shock of cold water in your shoes makes you feel at once the winter growing around you. It is not a thing far off. The anticipation of snow makes you keep looking up. You know snow will fall on the valley, that snow will cover the city, that soon wherever you look, you will see white snow.
This one's a science fiction poem. I guess it's kind of a computer poem, too. It's about virtual reality. It's called I Touch a Breath of Dreams. I went to Dachau to stop the Nazis, then on to Golgotha, Morning Christ, where I rolled the stone aside myself. On Stratford, the bard launched the tempest to the sound of marching boots, while the symphonies of Mahler wrung tears from me I had thought gone, water the dying children of Niger had stolen away for their swollen lips. Nietzsche and Freud argued while Einstein laughed and ciphered infinities on a dusty chalkboard outside of Rome. The Vatican called our Albert to demand an answer why he thought the world was round. He blessed the Pope with a kiss. I go among them all the while, anchored here. The Uint is a brown and dusty this year. There are beggars outside. Their hunger is soft, offline. While I stay among these others, I may serve. A corporeal angel at verity's edge, dizzy with worlds and pale in my cerements. In every one I touch a breath of dreams and spread a banquet for my friends, another 10 who have died in the evening news. The food in this place is mine to give. This time I think fish and wine to the starving millions in Marrakesh.
That's just off to Asimov's, isn't it?
I was born in Indiana, and I'm a convert to the church. This one talks about my mother who came to Fort Wayne, Indiana from Kentucky. It's called In the Big City. My mother came to the cracker factory from the green hills of Kentucky. All day long she stood at the line loading cookies into fluted papers, and she loved it. She made a quarter an hour, riches, enough to buy a second dress and to ride the bus to anywhere in the city she wanted to go. She went to the movies and to the amusement park and rode the Ferris wheel for a luxurious nickel. And it was much better than hoeing tobacco or cleaning up after her coal miner brothers. But she fell into sin, as her mother said all city people did. She bought a third dress, red, and she bought high-heeled pumps. And then she even wore that sinful grease on her lips. Worse, she went out with a rough Irishman. She had a soft southern accent, which delighted her co-workers but embarrassed her. So to show herself city sophisticated, she learned and said damn and hell. No worse, But one day she said them at home in her brother's home. All hell, well, by some other name, broke loose. Her mother said she absolutely had to return to Kentucky moral safety, but she would not. Soon after, she married that Irishman because she loved him, but also to escape the clutches of her family, who refused even to go to her marriage at the city hall. Life was not easy for them. No sweet cracker, she said. But pinching pennies forever was much better than the Kentucky backwoods fences of a mother who strained the quality of sin.
I'll read one of my science fiction poems. This is from a series I did about Persephone in the ancient Greek myth. This was Elizabeth I, on seeing Persephone walk through the gates of hell, and this was printed in Asimov's. She comes again there, Robert. Let me start again. I'm adding words. She comes again, Robert, there. Another half year marked. But for her, we would not stand here in any peace. Have I told you the story? She came to me, Robert, when I was lost among the millions crushing sticks, and said, do something for your people. Find a way to help them. And I lifted up my eyes and saw this hill. I need a staff, I said. So she brought me one of Charon's, and I set out to climb through all the clawing thousands that thronged these slopes, thousands babbling at me in the tongues of India and Cathay. And when I reached the top, the winds blew, yet I had nothing to fly from my staff but my red skirts. So I tore off a goodly part, tied that to this staff, and held it up in the wind that blew my hair and my torn skirts and my red flag. The multitudes rioting along sticks quieted and looked at me, and I shouted, England stands here. And they came to me, my English boys who drowned fighting Spanish fleets, my farmers, my generals, my sturdy village women, even my poets, even Walter came. And we made this hill a little England for the people of all the times of England, an island of safety, a refuge of peace in a sea of unexpected chaos. And we stand here yet, Robert. England yet stands here and will, till all the English have crossed Styx, and I, the last, will let them greet me on the other side.
I do have one Mormon poem, I guess.
By topic.
Shane asked me to write a poem at the death of Spencer Kimball, and this was published in Sunstone. It's called Chiefs. The land is dry, Spencer. The desert blushes with the setting sun, and the sheep bleat at rising stars in the sudden brightness of the moon. The wind is dry. It is cold on this night. Fall is here. I have been a chief. My tribe is old. I am old. My people dwindle. Yours too. You call them back with a shepherd's voice, and they come. Winter is a dry time here. The sheep stray too far looking for water. I have seen you on the reservation. I have seen you feed the sheep. Was there not a time when you did not weep and wipe the soiled feet of your folk with that cloak you wore? Spencer, you sleep today longer than you did before. By my fire you sang such music, a song made of a quiet voice. In the night I hear you whisper. My eyes are dry, Spencer. My heart is still. I see you when the stars walk. When you come again, will you sit with me a while? We will sing together in the wind.
It's beautiful. Well, our time is actually technically up. Thank you all for coming. Appreciate that. Okay. I'll read another science fiction poem while we're looking here. This was one that was also published in Asimov's. It's called Romeo to Juliet in Utah. They brought us here to Utah, Juliet, and I will love you again. I will see you in your father's house, and it will not matter that actors speak our family's names, our own names, wrong. You will still be more lovely than jewels in an Ethiop's ear. More lovely, Juliet, than that metaphor this audience may not understand. What hush? The chorus on stage? We must follow, but Juliet, see the crowd sitting in seats, there, waiting. What do men and women feel when they see us with our knives and potions, when they watch you kiss me, hoping not for love, but for poison?
Nice ending. This is a poem Shane has accepted for Sunstone and hasn't been published yet, but it will be. Watch for me, will you? It's called Catching Light. On summer evenings in Indiana, we kids ran through the neighborhoods catching lightning bugs. Most we put in bottles to light up the night. They ran over each other in the jars, flickering their tiny lights on and off. The biggest kids ran a contest to see who could catch the most. It took a lot to make a satisfactory light. At 6 or 8, we no longer believed our mother's tales of fairy folk with lanterns in the night. We could see they were just flying bugs with no feelings and no purpose but to give us games. The older kids taught the younger how to catch the tails of the bugs just as they lit and pinch them off a flame. If we smeared the little lanterns up our arms and over our faces, they left streaks of light. Then, in the final darkness, we ran screaming through the yards like lighted demons.
Wonderful poem.
This one's kind of a Mormon poem, too. It's called Lament of the Vestal Virgin. Kind of a Mormon poem. I spend my life a drying flower, a thin and thirsting weed adrift, a seed so ripe I swell against my thickening maidenhead, a laboring womb unbreached. A spindle flower such as this could carry seed and burst into, I wish I knew, a dandelion or a buttercup's womb. Men have wished upon such stars, caught and blew a breath of life into the spindles of their hair, then set them into soaring points where wishes couple to a fiery truth. But men, they ask familiar parts. Marry, nuncle, you know the jest. If I could, I'd conjure a prophecy. Fall's weed, too, will be taken up. Another direction at the gate, the lion's tooth, a chaff to separate, with a shuddering heave and a ditty sung going down. With three witches and a worm's tongue, a pinch of the root and I'd be done. There may be some burning yet. This star is born to be or not, its roots torn from beneath its earth, or held quiet and lustrous beneath a lover's chin.
That's great. Is that a new poem? Okay. Well, I'm not sure. Let's try this one. This is called When the Last Day Ends. And I can't remember where this was published. I think it was Asimov's, too. When the last day ends, when the last dream fades, when the last lovers kiss and turn away into the night, the last moon dims behind the last snow falling, falling when the last smoke clears, when the last wind stills, when the last eyes blink and stare at nothing, the last bird calls.
It would work in Asimov, wouldn't it?
Yes.
Here's a Mormon poem. It's called Women's Names. We carry our fathers and our husbands' last names. We are, first, daughters of our fathers, then wives of our husbands. Elizabeth Barrett Browning, Elizabeth Cady Stanton, Hillary Rodham Clinton, Lavinia Fielding Anderson. But closer to our inner selves are our first and middle names. Daughters carry the first name of their grandmothers, or whisper in the middle name of a mother's closest friend, tenderly remembering a woman beloved. Anna Eleanor Roosevelt, Emily Elizabeth Dickinson, Shirley Anita Chisholm, Laurel Ann Tanner. We honor our men. Yet there is a closeness in the bond of women that clings beyond time and space, an identity, a vigor, a sense of purpose, an understanding of who and what and why flows from the sounds of our women's names, harder to trace on a genealogy chart, but nearer to the heart.
This one I wrote for my thesis a long time ago. A lot of my early poetry is very narrative, and this is definitely one of them. It's called Death, and it's not repeated. Cretin, I said, and he laughed, a song of delight that wavered black and gold over my fresh grave. How would you like it, he asked, as though one lump or two would do the job. I came to tea, I said, and he poured me a wine thick and red and then smiled and handed me the cup. Tragedy is so perverse. I thought to spare you what? A fire? Drowning, perhaps? A beating by your friends? Some wild animal dining on the bones and blood that made you? You've had no shriek in the night, no tearing at your throat by knives or vicious teeth. My last customer saw a werewolf. Once. My shiver rippled the red in my cup. But I thought we were friends? Of course, he said. But why do you worry? Maggots must also eat, as you have often dined on long dead flesh. And I cleared my throat to say, your invitation was macabre, more than I expected on so bright a day. And he only smiled, held out his hand. I asked his price and did not wince at the cost of crossing sticks, but asked what manner my death would be. He gave no answer, but only turned in his consummate silence and tipped his roiling crown in rakish gesture on his head. I thought no more to chide him on his manners.
Well, here's as close to a Mormon poem as I brought with me today. This is going to be published in Dialogue. It's called The Time Traveler Comes to Cana, and it's part of a whole series of poems I'm doing about the time traveler who goes back to Palestine at the time of Christ. So I went to Cana and spent Sabbath in that house, their guest, before the wedding. The daughter spoke with joy of her marriage. The mother sat impatient. Sabbath's end, the time for her to cook what food they had. The father counted too few flasks of wine, again and again, too few for his guests. I would have given money. I had it. Roman drachmas hidden in bags of wrapped cups they thought I traded in Galilee. Take these cups, I told them. Serve the wine you have in them. And they marveled at the cup's craftsmanship, and I never explained. They were mass-produced in Mexico. Not one cup survived to become a new relic. I traced all 12 cups to the dumping grounds outside Cana, all broken in 3 years, fragments thrown out as if they meant nothing. So the wedding day came slowly for us. Then he came, and his mother. She and he sat at a table like all the others. I thought he did miracles. I'd proven that when I'd wandered through Judea 2 years after his undoubted crucifixion, hearing second-hand accounts of his work. So many thousands had seen him, had heard his words. Some few had seen him heal lepers or the blind. I talked to a once blind girl who wept to tell me how he spit on dirt to make mud, with which he anointed her eyes. She wiped it off and saw his face first. I could never find the lepers. Not one, once cured, ever admitted to that cure, ever said but for him I'd be unclean. So we ate and drank that day at the wedding, and I thought he did miracles. I thought, I have come so far to see one. I thought, will he know? Will he know how far I've come, or how quickly after I got permission, or how many years I tried for permission? And I thought, would he do it with me here, or would he wait till some other wedding in Cana? I knew the sequence of events, if I could trust the one evangelist. But when the wine ran out, I, impatient, called for more, as if I were drunk, as if there were more wine. And when the father brought what he thought would be water and poured it apologetically in empty cups, I heard the growing murmurs of surprise. I held my cup a long time, watching him, before I tasted what was in the cup.
It's very strong. This is a contrast again. I seem to be doing that a lot. This is called Elegance in Grandfathers. My mother's father, my grandfather Clemson, is a truly elegant man. When we children go to his house, he always greets us, "I am so glad that you have come." He shakes our hands, and when we brush against him to kiss his cheek, his tweed coat rubs our faces, and he smells of English leather. At Christmas, he takes us in his big black car to see the Nutcracker and then out for ice cream frappes afterwards. My dad's dad, my grandpa Leary, will never be elegant at all. When we kids go to his house, he shouts at us, "Hi there, you guys!" And then he kneels down and we climb all over him. And when we kiss him on the nose and he kisses our elbows, he smells of horses and liniments. And sometimes we get dog hair on our clothes. On our birthdays, he takes each one in his beat-up old pickup to a silly movie and out for pizza and malts. My mother says she certainly hopes we will grow up to be like her father. My dad only shakes his head. Maybe he doesn't understand about elegance.
This one I wrote for a child that I knew based on a dream that she had. And it's called Winter Lullaby. Hello, I hear you wail, lost and all alone. Can you find your way home? I am waiting with a candle in the dark unending storm. The night holds to its tears of snow. It howls, oh, with a misery that only demons know. Look past the cold black monster in his arms that hold the dead. He drags a doll home to its bed from dreams of mother's breast and sings voracious lullabies to babies' cries and crocodiles that tee the frigid chest. They know no rest that sleep in death, no rest that sleep in dark. Hark, there is a voice that's warm. Don't go out then into the winter storm. And if you go, know he and I are waiting for you there, me with one bright candle, and he with frozen hair.
That's great. Well, now we are out of time, I'm afraid, so thank you. Thanks again.